I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey guys, we got an ad. It's from superyaki.com. If you haven't been there yet, you really should go. It's this really cool website. You can go there. They have shirts for really great movies, also bad movies, but you know, the movies that Film Twitter says you shouldn't like, but they're a bunch of idiots because of course you like National Treasure. Of course you think Judy Greer is awesome. Of course you want pins with Sofia Coppola, which I think is down okay with Film Twitter, and also Jordan Peele, definitely okay with Film Twitter. Go to superyaki.com and buy your shit. I know Phil has a bunch of stuff from superyaki.com.
I have a bunch of shirts. I've got a written and directed by Rian Johnson shirt because I'm obviously a big Last Jedi fan. They got great Crimson Peak shirts, which is a fucking great movie that nobody talks about nearly enough. Their shirts are really soft. They're eco-friendly, water-based inks. They ship with compostable poly mailers for environmentally friendly alternative to online shopping. It's a great website. They're a great company. Karen Hahn, past and future guest, has a couple shirts that she's done with them as well, which is fantastic. And as a special gift to you, listeners can save 10% on their order with the code SUPERFRIEND, all caps, no spaces, that's SUPERFRIEND at checkout.
Can you believe this? You listen to our podcast and you get 10% off shirts and sweatshirts and pins and bags. Yep. From superyaki.com. This is a win-win for everybody, and we get none of that. Zero.
It's superyaki, that's SUPERYAKI.com.
See you at the movies. Hey there, 99ers. Are you a film fiend? Curious about how powerhouse filmmakers direct top-notch movies? Dive into the journey of Warner Brothers' most popular, prominent filmmakers starting September 15th. Learn about their movies and what led them to where they are today through behind-the-scenes footage and interviews. Tune in daily to youtube.com/Warner Bros Online. That's Warner Bros Online, starting on September 15th.
Yeah, so if you go to that website, you'll see that obviously there's going to be many films from these filmmakers. We have covered some of these filmmakers on our podcast. We covered Bringing Out the Dead with Martin Scorsese. We will eventually cover True Crime with Clint Eastwood. Yeah, and maybe more importantly, Stanley Kubrick, our very first episode was Eyes Wide Shut, his masterpiece. It will also be included in a digital bundle of the filmmaker's movies that we will be giving away on Friday. We're going to have some games or some sort of Twitter presence where we will give away a couple bundles of these filmmakers' movies, including Eyes Wide Shut, Mad Max Fury Road, Goodfellas, Million Dollar Baby, and The Green Mile. So check out our Twitter feed for that and check out youtube.com/Warner Bros Online for more information on this live stream. Thanks.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it. It's just podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like
Hello and welcome to Podcasts Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from in front of a wall of Ritz crackers here in 2020. I am one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iscove.
And with us today, live from Twitter, is Louis. I should have asked you before, is it Peitzman?
It's Peitzman.
I was gonna
let you know ahead of time, but then I thought I'd let you wing it.
I'm an EI as well, and I'm an Ibart, so I go with the German I usually.
The correct pronunciation, yeah.
Yeah, so the way the Germans do. But I would never Peitzman you.
Thank you. Unless you told me to.
But this is Louis Peitzman. He is a writer. He's written for New York Times, Vulture, Time, BuzzFeed, other publications. Huge on Twitter, retweeted constantly. You definitely have seen him on your feed, and he also chose Stigmata, so he's going to have to answer for that. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Louis. It's great to finally meet you and have you on.
Thank you for having me and making me watch Stigmata. I know it was my choice, but I still feel like, you know, I was pressured into it.
You know, so often guests come on this show, and I feel this most of the guest outreach. And so often I'm like, so why'd you choose this movie? And the person goes, because Phil made me. But what is the genesis of you and Stigmata?
I mean, I honestly chose it because I'd never seen it, and I'm a horror person, so I wanted something that was, you know, in the genre. Mm-hmm. And I remember the trailer from when the movie was in theaters, and it stuck with me. So I was like, I got to see this movie about Patricia Arquette having stigmata. as it turns out, I did not have to see it. I was actually fine. I would have been fine never having seen it, but
no one warned us.
The damage has been done. So, you know,
can you're a horror person and I'm not. So I have a question for you about this.
Yes.
Is this a horror movie?
Yeah, I think it's a horror movie. I think it's like, it's a
horrible.
Religious. It's
I'm just kidding. I don't think it's that bad.
Oh, I think it's pretty bad. wow, fascinating. No, I mean it's like, you know, it's in the genre of like religious horror, so it's like
okay.
The Exorcist or The Omen or all sorts, you know, there's like very much like a evil Catholic Church thing going on.
I guess the reason I ask is it's not scary.
It's not scary, but some of the imagery is
arresting.
I would call upsetting. It upsetting. It's like it's graphic. It's like, you know, if you're watching a really dark music video, I think that
quite literally it is a
music video, feature length. Yes,
I think that there is a distinction to be made, and I feel I'm sure you've made this, but horror doesn't necessarily mean scary. You know, like
it can be psychological. I guess, to some degree. Yeah.
I think the term unsettling is mm-hmm. probably more catch-all for horror than scary. Okay. And I think this does intend to be unsettling, and I would argue it is unsettling at times. I wasn't scared, but you know, I'm super tough. So,
wow.
So what are some of your favorite horror movies, Louis? What when you say you're a horror fan,
the ones that are actually good.
correct.
I'm a big Nightmare on Elm Street person. I'm a, the best. Like, that's my fave. I used to say Rosemary's Baby, problematic, so I kind of mumble that one. I would say that if not for Polanski and yeah, Halloween, you know, like good classic horror. Jennifer's Body is one of my favorite more recent, even though it's like 10 years old horror movies.
Yeah. What about The Exorcist? Is that up there for you or not really?
Yeah, I mean, I am a fan of The Exorcist. I'm also a fan of The Exorcist, the sequel, The Exorcist 2, which is a terrible movie. Mm-hmm. Because I like bad movies, which is partly why I was like Stigmata will be good, because like, even if it's bad, I can appreciate it on some sort of camp level.
And yet here we are.
I don't know if I got there with it. It was long, so
it's not that long is the thing. It just feels long.
It's an hour and 42 minutes, which is
for a horror movie, is that long?
I'm going to ride for Stigmata first.
Okay.
I think I did get there. I think that I tried to put myself in that exact place, right? I didn't necessarily expect it to be so campy. And obviously, you know, it wasn't intentional, but the best camp is not intentional. You know, you can't really be camp if you intend to be camp.
Right.
And I tried to put myself in the mind space of if I had watched this in 99 with the right audience, with the right group of friends, I think I would have had a lot of fun with this. And as it stood, like this, Phil, I think, and we should discuss this notion too, and you as well, Lewis, because I feel like you're, you know, kind of on this tip. I think this is the first movie that falls into that thing, that category that has been called so bad it's good. I think that's a ridiculous thing, but that's how this felt to me. Like, we've done a bunch of movies that we hoped were kind of like that, like The Haunting and The Other Haunting, but
lots of hauntings.
The Haunted House and The House on Haunted Hill, but those movies just straight up suck. And I think this is so silly and so ridiculous and so self-serious. And the performances, I do kind of get the sense that, like, Gabriel Byrne and Jonathan Pryce thought, maybe if things go right, I can get nominated for this. And I love that about it. Like, I love that they really
– I mean, I have to believe that Gabriel Byrne was, like, racking up some debt somewhere, because this was – he did two, like, religious thrillers in 99.
The other one's amazing. The other one's a great flick.
But – the point being that, like, I don't, there was something going on there with him. I hear you though. I think the fact that it is, I looked up the director after, because I was like, this guy has to be a music video director, because there's, and of course he is, but
he did play just any, well.
He's not just any musical director. he's MC Hammer's in-house musical director.
Well, and it shows. So definitely there are moments where it works for me. I think the problem with the movie that takes itself so seriously like this is that it wears thin after a while. So, you know, there are moments when I'm like, oh, it's really funny. They think they're doing serious art here, and this is ridiculous. But for me, like, after 80 minutes, I'm out. And this went on longer than that. So even Portia de Rossi's dreads could not save the movie for me.
Here's a question. Because as you know, I'm a scaredy cat, Kenny, and I don't watch horror movies. So I was really thankful that 99 doesn't really have any scary horror films for the most part.
Blair Witch is like scariest movie.
Sure. Right. And Blair Witch is great. Sure. But I guess what I kind of want to posit here is it feels like horror at this point, and I'm curious, Lewis, since you're a big horror person, it feels like it's in a weird lull here. Like, when your horror movies are the House on Haunted Hill and The Haunting, which are basically just special effects, kind of like theme park rides as opposed to actual horror films.
And this and End of Days and
right. Yeah. These are all big studio kind of it's a weird fork in the road that we're at. And Blair Witch, we talked about this on the Blair Witch episode, but Blair Witch opens up that whole new lane of found footage, of horror films that can be like shaky cam and whatever, all, you know, low budget, sort of
indie,
like, intellectual indie horror, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we did Audition as well, which also fits into that, because then you have the J-horror stuff, which comes out off of that too. So this, to me, feels like kind of this weird death rattle of the studio horror film.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're coming right between, like, the return of the slasher in the late 90s, but a little before this, and then in the early 2000s, you kind of start with torture porn, you're a few years out from Saw and Hostel. So you're kind of between two big moments in studio horror, and right. I can see how this sort of falls through the cracks, because it's not, you know, it is what it is. I think that there definitely was something going on in terms of what scared people in 99 with the devil and Catholicism. There was something happening.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, but I think that it had a very, like, religious overtone for people. So it caters to that, whether or not you find it scary now. So apparently at the time people were much more scared of Stigmata, I guess.
So so there's this, there's Stigmata. There's End of Days, as we discussed. There's also Ninth Gate, which is another, you know,
Polanski joint.
It's a Polanski joint. And, you know, obviously, like, the Rosemary's Baby and Exorcist and The Omen, these movies will be discussed over the course of this because it kind of is part and parcel of this Christian horror theme or this Catholic horror theme. I find it hard to believe that it's just the millennium.
Something was in the water, you think?
It's not even something. It can't just be some people just sitting around and saying the world is going to end in a very Catholic kind of way. That seems weird to me. It seems. What led to this? What was the big success in the years between The Exorcist and 1999?
Good question.
That made all these people think that let's do some devilish stuff. I mean, The Devil's Advocate was before this, right?
Yeah. Correct. And that's, I guess, the big one. Also not a great movie, but more entertaining.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. I'm trying to think of, like, what are.
Well, I was.
I mean, I'll look up. I'm going to look up 90s horror films for a second.
I was trying to see if the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal had happened at this point, but that was 02, so it was a little ahead of the game. But I was kind of surprised by, like, how staunchly anti-Catholic Church this movie was. It did seem very much. It seemed like almost transgressive. I don't really know what the conversation was around Catholicism in 99, but it surprised me.
It does feel a little bit like, so, and we've talked about Scream before on the podcast, but it does feel like that's a real kind of reckoning that the genre has with itself, because all of a sudden it becomes meta and it becomes sort of this, like, commentary on itself in a more sort of overt way than it had ever been before. And it feels like that's in 97. And it feels like after that, there's sort of this wave. Scream is 96?
Scream's 95.
95, okay. So even earlier than I thought.
Or 96. But this is not this does not share DNA with those movies.
No. I'm not suggesting that it does. Like, I'm just saying, like, where are studios' heads at when it comes to horror is where I was trying to come at.
I think studios' heads are at, and I think that's a good question, horror makes money. I think that is how a movie that this fucking insane winds up as a major summer release with, you know, movie stars.
Well, it was fall, but yeah.
It made, what, $85 million, and it had a huge campaign and $90 million. It was a very big release.
Yeah.
And it's insane and stupid and weird and crazy, and I can't believe a studio put its money behind it. But my sense is, horror made money, but studios never really understood how to do horror.
Right.
Right. Like, as we said, horror is, you know, this gave way to an indie boom, indie horror. It's always been indie. If you look back at the history of, like, horror movies and indie film, they're one and the same. Like, the biggest indie film for about 20 years was Halloween. People don't think of Halloween as an indie film because it doesn't really, you know, feel like your typical mumblecore shit. But Halloween is an indie film. Nightmare on Elm Street was an indie film, for instance.
But this stems from because they're low budget, right? And directors want to have sort of, you know, they want to make a film. You know, Evil Dead is another example of like, the first one is super cheap and low budget.
So is Peter Jackson stuff, Meet the Feebles. Like,
totally.
So this is what indie directors do in the beginning, most of them. And if you look at so many of our, you know, really, really strong indie directors, they come from this world. Mm-hmm. When the studios take it over, it almost always sucks. Like, sometimes it comes from a prestige novel like The Exorcist, and that's kind of a different story.
Yeah.
But it almost,
Or Rosemary's Baby.
But it almost always sucks. And Scream is even, like, pretty much an indie film as well. That's mid 90s Miramax Dimension before, you know, swallowed up. So I guess
I hear you, and I'm also trying to imagine an indie version of Stigmata that's any better than what we got. I mean, like, I guess I want to know, like, where it went wrong, because it seems like from a script level,
conception,
you know, yeah, exactly. I mean, there's nothing about Stigmata totally that really agree. Makes sense.
Conception. Catholic horror goes wrong at conception almost always.
Well,
which is it's so weird that, like, in like 4 or 5 years, well, really in like 2 or 3 years, Dan Brown starts putting out The Da Vinci Code,
yep,
which then becomes like the biggest franchise in the world for a while, both in, you know, books and movies. So there is certainly an appetite here somewhere, and an appetite for the big budget shit, but for a while they couldn't get near it.
Yeah, I mean, they also, you're absolutely right with the Da Vinci Code comparison, because they obviously are going for this alt history of Jesus thing that people would eventually come to love. Perhaps Stigmata was ahead of its time, and it would have taken, you know, a great mind like Dan Brown to transform this story into something more palatable to mainstream audiences. I don't know.
I mean, I'm also looking, just for what it's worth, at the credits of these screenwriters who I don't, the screen, part of the issue here is,
what are their names?
It's on a script level. The screenwriters of this film are Tom Lazarus, which is an appropriate last name.
Is that a pseudonym?
I don't know. And Rick Ramage? I don't know.
Ramage, I think.
Ramage, maybe. Yeah. They did not really go on to do much else. But the reason I bring up the script here is because, and I hope that you guys can help me in this regard, because I watched all of this film and I'm still not entirely sure I understand what was attacking her and why she was getting stigmata.
Oh, I can explain. Was that ever? Oh, yeah.
Oh, great. Okay, great.
This is it's not clear at all. But I have my own I have my own interpretation.
Okay, good. I'm gonna want to hear that.
Sure.
Let me just lay a little bit of groundwork here in terms of some context for our listeners who might not have seen Stigmata. The synopsis of the film is: a young woman with no strong religious beliefs, Frankie Page, played by Patricia Arquette, begins having strange and violent experiences showing signs of wounds that Jesus received when crucified. When the Vatican gets word of Frankie's situation, a high-ranking cardinal, played by Jonathan Pryce, requests that Reverend Andrew Kiernan, played by Gabriel Byrne, investigate her case. Soon, Kiernan realizes that very sinister forces are at work and tries to rescue Frankie from the entity that is plaguing her. Stigmata opened on September 10th, 1999, in first place with $6.5 million against Stir of Echoes and Love Stinks. Quite a weekend. It would go on to make $90 million on a $29 million budget. This movie didn't look like $29 million, by the way. Like, it's fine.
Doves are expensive. They had a huge dove budget.
It looked genuinely awful, but it doesn't feel like 29 is too much of a number for this movie. We've seen crazier things.
Stigmata has 22% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 63% from audiences, which I find surprising, but it makes sense that it made that much money. I guess people were into it. Roger Ebert's review is kind of a bunch of religious gobbledygook, so I didn't really pull anything from it. But it should be said that Gabriel Byrne was nominated for a Razzie Award for Best Supporting Actor for his performance in both this film and End of Days. But he lost to Ahmed Best as Jar Jar Binks in...
Everything about that is bullshit.
I got a real problem. The Razzie Awards, I have some real issues with.
So does Kenny.
Everybody with a soul and a decent heart has issues with the Razzie Awards. But that said, specifically, one, Gabriel Byrne's actually excellent in End of Days.
I agree.
Two, this is weird that he plays like the opposite character in the same movie.
Correct.
Once he's playing the devil, and the other one he's playing the man trying to exorcise the devil from someone else. So that's just shows his range. And two, I am not the first person to say this, but like, how could you? Come on with this Jar Jar shit. All right, that's all.
Yeah, no.
What are your feelings on the Razzies? Just real quick.
Oh, I think the Razzies, I don't know. They often get it wrong. they often nominate people who are bigger names who made flop movies but actually are good in those movies.
Yep.
That's a big problem with them. And I don't know. I've seen way worse movies and way worse performances than anything that ever gets mentioned in the Razzies. So especially in recent years, it seems more about getting publicity for being the Razzies.
I take issue with the Razzies as well, despite the fact that I probably quote unquote enjoy them more than Kenny does. But my issue with the Razzies really has to do with the fact that it seems to be like this corrective measure against studios. Because to your point, there are a lot of like indie films that are made that aren't good, but it's a lot of like just poking fun at big movie stars and trying to take them down a notch.
Which is probably, I mean, if this is going to exist, that's what it should be, right? Like, as you know, Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel always did a worst of for the year, but they had a rule that they didn't punch down. You know, that's not the explicit rule, but the rule was, we're not going to go after small indies and say they're the worst. We're going to go after large films who can take it. That being said, like, it's not, I mean, we have a podcast, we talk shit about all these movies, but we're like, you know, we're small time nobodies, so we don't put it out there on blast.
I was told you had a wide listenership, and this was going to be.
We will not be on it. We're very popular among other small time nobodies, but when it comes down to it, I think we really love these movies and love what we do, and I think that the whole thing is born out of like a genuine love. I just fear that the Razzies watch these movies looking for who can we embarrass this year.
Right.
Correct.
My beef with this particular nomination is that Gabriel Byrne does not give the worst performance in this movie.
Not even close.
Oh, I agree with you.
I think that Patricia Arquette is actively bad in the movie, and she's a great actor. It's not, I think it's a script problem and a director problem. But she's terrible. She's like shockingly not good.
Yeah. She's playing to all of her worst instincts, which I think speaks to direction, or maybe she wasn't directed. I don't know. But there's just a lot of like Patricia Arquette, I don't want to say tics, but like there are kind of, you know, things that she goes to as an actor. And it feels like she's wearing all of them on her sleeve in this performance.
Right. I mean, I wrote down some lines though, and that I feel like no one could have delivered well. And I think that maybe like it is like a tone problem. Like when she says like, am I psychotic or dying or both? I feel like maybe if that were played a little more tongue in cheek, it would have worked, but it's played sort of sincerely. And then she starts laughing. I don't know. Her character's also a mess because she's like kind of a bad girl, but also kind of not. Like she's like, is she a mess or is she just like a normal atheist who enjoys sex? It's not clear to me.
There was a part of me that felt like they almost needed to go farther with how quote unquote lost she is. Like if it was some sort of substance abuse, if whatever it is, like it just felt like there was a part of me that watched this performance and watched this character. Like for instance, Kenny, we had in End of Days, Robin Tunney plays, right? So like, Robin Tunney's character in that film, like you're rooting for her, like you're invested in her. In this, I just didn't know how to feel about Frankie.
So I was going to bring up Robin Tunney too, and I was going to lay the Patricia Arquette is one of my favorite actresses. Like
she's great. Yeah.
Period. I love what she did when she was young. I love what she's doing now. Like she's like truly incredible in the roles that suit her. Notably, she's almost never in any kind of genre film. Because it's just there's something about Patricia Arquette that is so grounded, real world.
Yeah.
And I understand that to some extent, you know, the devil goes inside a real person, but those scenes that are terrible to me are the scenes that are heightened, that feel like someone who is more committed to the bit, like Robin Tunney, would have just killed it. And I think the whole movie would have been better.
When you say over the top, are you, and I'm for me, it was the attack scenes.
Well, I'm not, I didn't, yeah, I said heightened. So
yeah,
we're saying the same thing. We're saying that the scenes where she essentially is embodied by a devil or the demon, whatever, and has to like kind of raise up and be scary and foreboding, whether she's being scared, whether she's being threatening to those in the room with her or threatening to herself. Yeah. I didn't feel that. It just turned into, you know, high camp at that point. And that's kind of when I decided this would be fun watching this with the right audience, because it's not even a matter of misreading it. Like, she just didn't go there, or she can't go there.
Well, the director is also, I mean, the moment that for me, when I was like, what are we doing here, is when she's writing that stuff on the wall. And then she turns around and she's like full on exorcist, kind of like possession, speaking in like a man's voice. And like, she's got some crazy like eye shit going on. And you're just like, what's happening here? Like, anyway,
I do want to bring up really quickly that she did, you know, get her start in Nightmare on Elm Street, Dream Warriors. So she gets some credit for that. I don't think she was particularly good in that movie either. But let's at least acknowledge she has a horror history that she was also not great in. But I think you're right. The over the top stuff doesn't work. But I think, again, that's a lot. You know, the script is so hard to work with, and the way she has to kind of pivot from these weird, like almost romantic comedy scenes. I mean, they're like, are they falling in love? I don't know what's happening. And then it's like she's supposed to be kind of sexy and then like fun and messy, but then also she's speaking with a man's voice and she's terrifying, allegedly, whatever. It's a lot of flip-flopping that it would be hard to pull off for anyone, but especially Patricia Arquette in this particular movie.
Well, you know, it's like you mentioned Jennifer's Body.
Yes.
Meg Fox could have pulled this off.
Absolutely.
Totally. It doesn't feel like it doesn't feel like you had to dig that deep to find somebody who would have just chewed this up. But I do want to say the moment I turned on the movie, mm-hmm. because I basically feel the way you guys feel, and then in the end of the day, I was just kind of like, you know, I'm going to choose to like this. But the moment I turned on positive was the scene where it's the exact scene you shouldn't like in this movie, I guess, but it's the tender scene between them where they're talking about sex and he's saying, I wasn't born a priest. And there's something about the moment where I go, you know, these two can and have in their lives had chemistry with, like, you know, oak trees. Even these two with their massive age difference and like their world difference, and they feel like they're coming out of different movies. There's something really tender about that moment that I really liked. And then she immediately goes into like stage three of Stigmata, falling over like a bunch of cassava melons and like coming up bloody. And I was like, all right, this is fun. Now, where I would have gone is full Thornbirds with this. Like, 100%, because it's so rare people go Thornbirds. So I would have gone full Thornbirds and had them fucking for the back half of this movie. Why not?
I mean,
they do. I mean, they basically get there. They're quite intimate. I think they might as well have gone all the way. But you're right.
But like, exactly, because in the eyes of Jonathan Pryce, who plays his, like, you know, high superior priest or whatever, they did. He's like, I didn't expect you to come in this room and see you two in bed together.
Canoodling.
leave some space for the Holy Ghost.
But I think also if they had been sleeping together, it would have at least that's kind of what we're looking for in general, right? Is it like this movie needed to be a little bit more, needed to go there more in some way, beyond these like insane scenes of her, you know, getting whipped and stuff. It's like weirdly restrained. And I think that it starts off, you think it's going to be something different. It has this statue crying blood. And then you know, once we have that scene, we cut to like a very 90s song and there's a club. And then she's having sex with Patrick Muldoon from Starship Troopers. And it's intercut with Christ getting nailed to the cross, which is like an amazingly on the nose and also tacky. Like, I love that. Like, the back and forth, like, she's getting nailed, he's getting nailed. It's like a whole thing. And then I felt so let down because it was, like, not on that level. You know, it was like they actually wanted me to care about her and some, you know, there was more plot than I needed. And then it was like, this is based on a true story. This is based on a vaguely true myth, you know, whatever it is. Like, it's not the tone that I want for this movie. I wanted more sex intercut with Jesus being nailed to a cross.
There's a lot to unpack there. That was great work. That's why. All right. So one, they didn't have sex. They were afraid to go there. The Thornbirds was so controversial because they sexualized the priest, right?
Yeah.
Like that in some ways is kind of the last beacon that we're not willing to go towards in terms of controversy.
But so how could this movie not be controversial? I mean, they have the Catholic Church trying to kill this woman for revealing the secret that Jesus does not care about your religion and that churches are bullshit. Like, to me, this feels like a very controversial, you know, anti-Catholic movie.
You know, it's going to sound weird. You're totally right. And yet I think that is less controversial than having a priest get down. I do. I just think there's something sacrilegious about that they weren't willing to do. Otherwise, like, why wouldn't you do it? If it was any other movie, if he wasn't a priest, if he was an investigator, some kind of secular investigator, those two are fucking. So that's the one thing. The other thing you said is, okay, so the movie starts with the statue crying blood, I believe somewhere outside of Sao Paulo. And then it goes to that legitimately amazing credit sequence that you were talking about.
The most 90s credit sequence we've done so far, for sure.
Phil, is that you didn't like that. That you wanted the first movie, where I was like, this first movie they're showing me is going to be two of the worst hours of my life.
No.
They got to like the goth punk scene where Nia Long of all people is like the queen of the goth punk scene.
Yeah.
I was in.
No. Just to be very clear, I wanted the movie you wanted. And it sounds like the movie that you wanted as well, Lewis, which is this idea of like a movie that understood how dumb it was. Do you know what I mean? And it was just like, we're going to take you on a ride. It's going to be silly. It's going to be filled with some of the most like overt 90s music video editing and photography we can possibly jam into this thing. And those moments to me are when the movie at least becomes fun to watch, even if unintentional. When I think about the bathtub sequence, when she's having a bath and she's surrounded by all the candles, and then she has the first like nails in her hands and she's thrashing around in the water, and this ridiculous score that Billy Corgan of all people did is just like
score.
It's very funky. It's a very funky score.
There's a
his only score that he's ever done.
The scene I referenced earlier is a particular offender on the score front, because it's very like kind of like treacly, right? And then she has her whatever she has her thrashing stigmata bouts, it turns into like that part in 127 Hours when he cuts the nerve and it just goes. It's like, is this what stigmata felt like in the 13th century? Like before they had like death techno?
It's the other thing too is there's like some of my favorite artists are on this soundtrack, just to be above board. Bjork and David Bowie and Massive Attack are all on this soundtrack and all have needle drops in this movie that sort of work. So like I can't totally hate on the music choices necessarily, although it should also be said that Chumbawamba is also on the soundtrack. So like, it's really a whole potpourri of
bonus
stuff.
Points for that is what you're saying.
No, not really. I mean, more to the point of like, at least the music supervisor had good taste is
but
really
bonus
kind of
points for Chumbawamba. Is, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Is this better or worse than the Pokemon soundtrack? The very strong Pokemon soundtrack.
The Pokemon soundtrack is filled with bangers.
It is.
Those songs get stuck in your head. I can't say otherwise. I just think that. So Rupert Wainwright, who directed this film, did Blank Check. He did the Blank Check movie. Very bad movie.
Seen it six times.
You really?
My kids like it. Believe it or not, my son, who's obsessed with money, loves the movie where the kid gets the blank check.
Fair enough. This is one of those movies where the tonal shifts are so severe, and it's clear that he doesn't really know what kind of movie he's making. Because to your point earlier, Kenny, I agree. When this movie slows down and has some quiet moments between Patricia Arquette and Gabriel Byrne, it's not terrible. Like, it's not great, but like, they're both competent actors that can find some sense of nuance. But then literally at the end of that scene, she'll be thrashing around like a lunatic in the middle of like a diner.
In that scene where they're flirting and then she falls over because she's getting nails in her feet, I was just thinking, like, she's wearing platforms, right? And it's like, you're going to have a scene where someone in platforms is getting nails through her feet. You have to approach that with some sort of ironic detachment. Like, it's not, they're not Jesus sandals, they're platforms. And she's wearing them. And I think that we need to acknowledge that. And also acknowledge the fact that, you know, as you said, it's a very confused movie. And I think that, like, plot wise, it's very confused. And I think that it would have helped if the director didn't try to make sense of it, but rather just gave us, you know, those opening moments of 90s absurdity.
Yep.
So because it doesn't make any sense.
So the one movie that we haven't mentioned, which I don't know how I didn't mention this, I'm almost embarrassed, mm-hmm. that clearly is its forebearer, is Seven. Seven.
Oh yeah.
Seven is essentially, it's gothic horror. It's modern gothic horror. It's not quite playing on the same biblical themes, but there is, you know, the kind of a biblical thing going on there. And the numerical thing, you know, seven, it's overt, but this is the whole Gabriel Burns thing, is there are five stigmata, phases. Marks. Yeah. Phases. And no one's ever gone through even three of them. And you're
so how do they know? Four. How do they know there's five then?
Exactly.
They speak to God, Lewis. I mean, come on.
I have some questions.
But I think I think on every level, this seems like an attempt to recreate Seven. For hiring a music video director.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
To hiring a music video director, to using the front man of a major fucking alt band at the time for the music.
For the score.
To the biblical-ish gothic themes, to the color palette, the color palette they use, to the fucking constant rain, which is a big thing they use in Seven, very much on purpose in Seven, and it just seems here that they've decided Seven did it, so we should also, to the gothic buildings they're in.
You're hitting the nail right on the head. This is definitely trying to rip off Seven for sure.
Seven, I think, is a movie that, like, I would call a thriller. You know, it has horrific elements, right. But I think it's more of a thriller. And I do think that in a way, this movie was aiming for that kind of thriller territory. I think when you have possession and stuff, for me, it's, you know, it's horror. But I think they were going for that particular genre of Seven-esque, you know. A thriller with really horrific imagery that's going to stick with you.
So, Lucy, I think you hit on something, though. Possession is tough because you have to make a big decision in that you don't have to make it a serial killer movie or an abduction movie or anything like that. You have to decide how much of this possessed character you're going to show, right? How much of this I mean how much of that possessed character will be your POV in this movie? In End of Days, she wasn't really possessed. She was more Rosemary's Baby, but still, like, she is your character who is in some way harboring Satan inside her body. And you go with her a little bit, but you're mostly with the people, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is trying to fix this problem. Same with The Exorcist to some extent. But here, the main character is the person who is being possessed. And that in and of itself is kind of a tough place to go, because at some point, she stops becoming herself. She stops being the protagonist of the movie, and the protagonist is then gone. That's a weird thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's also weird because there's no reason for her to be possessed, which I think is like one of those plot
that's
issues.
A big problem, yes.
That like there's no if that's not really part of the story. Like we understand. Like I'm willing to buy the whole she's experiencing the wounds of Christ. Just go with it. But then suddenly. You know, in the movie, she becomes possessed in a way that doesn't actually track. And so it's not only that you have to kind of follow her as she's not herself. It's that, like, it's not clear who she is.
The text of the, yeah.
I don't know if the movie knows who she is. I have my explanation, but it's doesn't actually make sense.
I would like to hear your explanation.
So would I, but the text of the movie's fucked up. And
yes,
you're right. Yeah. It, near the end, when she is fully possessed, she explicitly says the messenger doesn't matter, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we just did The Messenger with Joan of Arc, and the point of that movie is almost the opposite, which is like people are chosen specifically for what they can do and who they are and what their abilities are. And I think that was Gabriel Byrne's point throughout the movie. It's always big believers. It's St. Francis of Assisi. Like, we're talking about, you know, the greats of Catholicism who get stigmata, not random people. So that left you, you know, that leaves you very cold. And I know people like kind of are into the idea that raised parents are supposed to be nobody, but like in a raised parents are nobody's way, like that matters. It matters to me why these people are put in these places, and you don't get to kind of just, you know, write it away with one line and having saying it doesn't matter.
Well, I think that one of the main issues here is that she's not, you know, the movie could have gone the way of like, maybe she needs saving and that's why this is happening to her, or maybe she's secretly divine. But really what's happened is she's been mailed a haunted rosary and stolen from a dead guy, and that's why she's experiencing this. So it is totally arbitrary. There's no reason why this is happening to her. She just had her mom mailed her that haunted rosary.
But it didn't have to be that way,
which
right?
Weirdly, yeah. Didn't have to be, but weirdly, like, Gabriel Byrne never discovers this. There's never any explanation, which we know as the audience, we saw the opening scene that like some kid just like stole this rosary from Father Almeida, and now she's, you know, possessed by him / Jesus / whoever else.
Because, whoever can get on in there.
It's a party.
It's a party. It's Patricia Arquette.
Can I just, I keep thinking about the Seven comparison, Kenny, and the reason Seven works is because it's a masterpiece. But one of the big things is how clean that premise is. He's doing the seven deadly sins. This, you're so unclear as to what's going on, and not in a good way, that you check out, and then every now and then the movie basically grabs you by the lapels and is like, but look at this crazy shit that's happening. She's got fucking crown of thorns. And you're like, but why? Like, there's just, I that was what made me tap out of this film ultimately, was that I was just like, I don't know what the fuck's going on or why it's happening.
The scene that I've referenced a few times is when Gabriel Byrne explains exactly what's happening.
Yes.
That's not such a bad thing to do in a movie, right? That should have happened early on. The clear version of this movie, because it happens very early in Seven, the clear version of this movie is you're going to get five lashes from God. I don't even know what to fucking say. Like, if you get all five, fucking the devil comes. This movie's stupid.
But you understand what I'm saying. Like, I understood the organizing principle. Like, I understand the organizing principle that, like, there's five phases and she's going to have these stigmatas. Okay, fine. So be it. But why?
Yeah, what does it mean? You're right.
Because Father Almeida, who discovered the secret gospel written by Christ himself that the Catholic Church is trying to suppress, died. Yeah. And then his spirit imbues her. And through that, maybe Jesus. But if it is Jesus, he's really mean. And I don't know if Jesus would be so angry while possessing someone. But yeah, basically...
I'll give you all of that, because I think all of that makes
it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense,
But the bigger thing is, what's the end game? To what end? Like, making this woman have these stigmata, to what point? Like, it's one of those things where, like, I understood the nihilism of Seven. I understood that this guy was trying to teach a lesson of some sort. This. Is the thought process that, like, if there's a person that has these stigmata, it will validate the church, like validate that Jesus was real or something? Like, I just don't understand, like, what our bad guy's mission is exactly in this movie.
Well, I don't know if it is a bad guy. I think it's very confusing, but I think that, like, his only point was trying to get the gospel out and to kind of the gospel being that, like, Jesus wrote, you know, in his own words, doesn't matter, you know, churches don't matter, religion doesn't matter, follow my teachings, which the Catholic Church then tries to suppress because that sort of undermines everything they're doing.
Right.
And so he's just trying to get the message out. And I think the stigmata is whatever he was experiencing because he was so close to God. And she's just experiencing that by proxy, but I don't know that there's like an intent beyond that she has a haunted rosary.
I appreciate that you can answer any of this.
I don't think it makes sense. I'm just saying that's what I think that's
I don't know where they're going. The more you talk about it, the more you talk about it, the more it makes sense. Like, yeah, it was there. I just didn't pick up on it.
But I mean that explanation does not actually. It doesn't explain why she gets possessed and starts throwing him around and yelling. It doesn't, or why she tries to seduce him. If she's Father Almeida, why is she trying to seduce Gabriel Byrne? And how does Jesus figure into this? Is everyone just horny for Gabriel Byrne? Is everyone just looking for her to have sex with the priest because we know that would make the movie more interesting? Like, I don't know what the logic is there.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, we'll be back with the podcast in a couple of minutes, but first, a word from our sponsor. That's right, we got a sponsor. Folks, do you love movies? The good ones? Even the bad ones everyone told you not to like? It sounds like Super Yaki is the place for you. The team at Super Yaki loves movies so much that they decided to dedicate every waking moment of their lives to bringing you top-quality merchandise to showcase your love for them.
From super soft t-shirts rightfully demanding a production of a third national treasure to comfy sweatshirts that reasonably serve as a call to arms for all those in support of making Judy Greer America's lead. They even have pins of some of your favorite directors like Sofia Coppola and Jordan Peele. Super Yaki joyously brings your tangible love letters to movies and filmmakers that you can wear with pride.
Plus, the team at Super Yaki screen prints all their apparel using eco-friendly 100% water-based inks and ships with compostable poly mailers for an environmentally friendly alternative to online shopping.
And as a special gift to you, listeners can save 10% on their order with the code SUPERFRIEND. All caps, no spaces. That's SUPERFRIEND at checkout. And if the spirit moves you, find them at superyaki.com. Let's watch more movies. That's Super Yaki, SUPERYAKI.com.
Hey, 99ers, we have something really excited to tell you guys about. Beginning Tuesday, September 15th, go behind the scenes and follow the journey of some of modern cinema's most celebrated directors, including Scorsese, Eastwood, Kubrick, and more. Warner Brothers will feature its series, Hollywood's Most Influential Filmmakers, on YouTube daily starting September 15th. Go to youtube.com/Warner Brothers Online for more information.
Yeah, so basically, if you go to that website, you'll see that obviously there's going to be films from all these various filmmakers. We have done episodes talking about these filmmakers. You know, we've talked about Scorsese with Bringing Out the Dead. We're going to talk about Clint Eastwood with True Crime. And our very first episode was Eyes Wide Shut. Eyes Wide Shut will obviously be featured in this online live stream that Warner Brothers is doing, but it's also going to be in a digital bundle that we're going to be doing a giveaway for, which includes Eyes Wide Shut, Mad Max Fury Road, Goodfellas, Million Dollar Baby, and everyone's favorite, The Green Mile. So also a 99 movie. But check it out. Go to youtube.com/Warner Brothers Online and also check out our first episode on Eyes Wide Shut. Thanks for listening to that ad, guys. Now back to the show. So essentially the film opens in a Brazilian village of Bella Quinto with Father Andrew Kiernan, played by Gabriel Byrne, a former scientist and Jesuit priest. I can't imagine there's many of those. Who investigates supposed miracles and examines the statue of the Virgin Mary weeping blood at a funeral for Father Almeida, who was previously experienced stigmata. While Andrew is collecting evidence, a young boy steals a rosary from the father's hand and then sells it to a woman in a marketplace who sends it to her daughter, Frankie Page, living in Pittsburgh. Which, by the way, just for what it's worth, the original title of this film, believe it or not, was St. Francis of Pittsburgh.
Incredible. What a title.
So that's what bad. A title.
I love it.
That movie does not make $90 million.
She lives in the Eastern Building, which is a pretty famous like downtown LA landmark. And they show it over and over again. And it drives me nuts because I thought they were in LA for the longest time.
But they're
this is not an inconspicuous building. This is a very large building downtown with a giant sign that says Eastern. Mm-hmm. With a loft building. So that annoyed the shit out of me, but I'm sure people
reasonably
the rest of the country don't care.
But all that being said, St. Francis of Pittsburgh is a tremendously bad title, but I love it. And then basically we cut to our alt rock 90s credit sequence where we see sort of this kind of condensed timeline of Frankie's life, I guess, to some degree. It's like fucking and drinking and lots of, loud music. And then we see her getting sort of nailed by this guy and all this sort of shit. Then she wakes up the next morning in a truly gigantic bed with a fucking preposterous headboard that I'm still not.
She's a very small person, though.
and your money goes a lot farther when you're in Pittsburgh. You can afford that headboard.
The headboard looks like something out of like it's like an Art Deco subway station or something like that. It's gigantic. Anyway, I couldn't not see it. Anyway, then Frankie thinks she's pregnant.
She was chosen for the production design of her apartment.
Perhaps
they knew that would be a great place for the climax of an exorcism movie.
Either way, she then thinks she's pregnant for like a good 10 or 15 minutes. And she thinks that might be why she's feeling weird. But then shortly thereafter, she's attacked by an unseen force while bathing and receives these brutal wounds on her wrists.
Brutal.
Even though I was explaining what I thought was the plot to you, by the way, I forgot that she thought she was pregnant, which and the song that plays when that opens the movie is Whatever Happened to Mary. And it's like, there's obvious, she's supposed to be, there's some sort of virgin birth thing happening here, even though she's like explicitly not a virgin. But that is forgotten very quickly by me as well.
Swept away. Swept right under the rug.
Can I use this opportunity to ask Ritz Crackers?
Sure. Ritz Crackers.
What?
I don't know.
What is that?
I don't know.
That's it? For those who
haven't
seen
this movie,
maybe
they paid some money. Did they put some? Maybe they put some money into it.
Let's assume they did. It still doesn't explain why it is used as essentially wallpaper for an entire giant wall in this loft. She has. It's got to be like 6x20 Ritz cracker boxes adorning a wall, and they're never mentioned. And they're never broken. Like, no one's thrown through them.
Do you think it's like a...
I think it's
a communion wafer
thing. Yes, I think it's a wafer thing.
Oh.
But, like...
That makes sense, too.
But what?
I was going to say that it feels like such a, like, kind of cool 90s sort of pop culture-y thing. But... wafers makes more sense.
Well, no, I was going to say that I feel like Ritz was having a moment... And I think that, like, that was sort of the body of Christ of the 90s. it was like a warm, buttery Ritz cracker.
The body of Christ of the 90s. Well, in a pinch, it'll work. It will save your soul. But all right. I can't. It's one of the strangest decisions I've ever seen in a movie, period. Okay, go ahead.
So then she goes to the hospital, understandably. Lots of blood, looking like she's harmed herself. And that sort of seems to be kind of, they go on that track for a while, in terms of like this, her friends start to think that there's something wrong with her.
You saw who played the doctor, like this, right?
No, who played the doctor?
Ann Cusack.
Okay.
Great. That means nothing to you?
No.
John Cusack and Joan Cusack's sister?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, she talks exactly like Joan Cusack. She has the exact same Joan Cusack.
I believe
voice.
You.
You've never seen her in anything, Ann Cusack?
I'm sure that I have, but can I honestly say that the way this film is shot, you basically can't fucking tell anybody.
That's true.
Like, it's, I was just like, there is so much random extreme close-ups with like desaturated, contrasty fucking photography that you just can't tell who the fuck anybody is.
That's, but anyway, that's, yeah. That's definitely why you didn't know who Ann Cusack was.
No, it's why I didn't. Anyway. So basically, Frankie asks a priest if he's Andrew Kiernan, the scientist, priest, and investigator. But this priest is Father Durning, and the lights in the train start to flash. And Frankie is now crucified inside the train, arms outstretched, being whipped while this priest recognizes what's going on. Because he obviously is like, well, that's obviously
strange. I have to say, I thought the subway derailment was kind of effective. Not the crucifixion part of it, but the actual derailment I thought was pretty scary as someone who,
sure,
pre-pandemic took the train quite often. I have not since March, but I, sure, you know, rode it every day. So I was scared of that.
End of Days also had some train, beautiful, some subway stuff. on it too, so I guess there is something, and that makes a lot of sense to me. Like, I mean, Louis, you've obviously been on the New York subway tons of times. There is kind of this, you know, a lot of these tunnels have been around for over 100 years, so there is like this sense that they're like ghosts and, you know, kind of spirits living down there. If you look down like various little, you know, alleys or side, creepy, sideways down there, you know, they have old stations and they have old art, and it does lend itself to this kind of thing. We'll say one thing that
this
was,
is the same subway car they used apparently in a Seinfeld episode. So you have that to also think about.
I will say one thing.
So clear
one thing
now.
I found kind of interesting about this is, in general, when you have something like this happen to a character, something supernatural, there is always the first act, but nobody believes me thing. All of her things out after the first one happen like in broad view of people who matter to the movie, right? Like, are like other characters are very much aware that she is bleeding randomly, that she is not cutting herself, that she is, you know,
well, that makes me yeah, think about the fact that after the subway situation happens, they cut to a shot outside the train and you just see a bunch of people just like run out of the train car, just like into the street. And I'm just like, I couldn't help but laugh thinking about like just these fucking people, these like just people on the subway, yeah, running into the street, having just witnessed this fucking crazy thing.
If it took place in New York,
they were distracted. Exactly. Yeah. Right. I thought it was New York. I didn't really think about where it was.
Yeah, they're Pittsburghians, so that is the craziest thing they've ever seen. But, you know, New York's have like 7-foot black pythons on the track. So no care.
Sure.
I have to say, I think talking about the subway scene and thinking about it more and the bathtub scene, I feel like this movie was pitched based on those two scenes. Like maybe it was like, we're going to have this, she's in the bathtub with candles, then suddenly like there's nails through her wrist and we're going to have a scene of a subway derailment and she's getting whipped and like, That was it, and then they just kind of filled in these kind of weird details around it. Because I can see, based on those two scenes, if you could like do it really well, how that would be a cool, freaky, late 90s horror movie.
Yeah, and you know, we should also acknowledge this isn't something that would happen today or something that people would think today, but people were creepy then, and this was definitely pitched as like some sexy bondage shit.
Yeah,
you know, like there was this idea of like Patricia Arquette being, you know, basically like, you know, I'm not going to get too much further into it, but you understand what I'm saying. I think that it was pitched as sexy. I think it was pitched as a sexy thriller.
But that's what's so weird about how not sexy it is. because they really hold back on that front. That they could have gone full, you know. She works in this like tattoo parlor, hair, like it's a barbershop where they do piercings. There's like something weird going on there with, again, Portia de Rossi with dreads. And, you know, there is a sort of this, there could have been more of an underground BDSM, whatever scene going on. But they hold back.
Probably because it was, you know, a studio movie, and probably because they were a little afraid to go full bore in that direction.
No, I would agree with you, Kenny, but I also felt like the movie I thought about a little bit when I was watching this, which I should have made the connection to Seven, was Eight Millimeter.
Yeah.
Because it has that kind of seedy underground sort of vibe, but never fully goes for it.
Do you think Eight Millimeter is a better movie than this?
Yes.
I have to say, like, we're talking about how, you know, she wasn't really dark enough. She wasn't really like, she wasn't messy enough. When her mom calls her and they have this great relationship, that was immediately when I was like, I don't understand this character at all. Because I assumed like that she was, you know, they play her up as this like drunken mess. And then it's like, no, she seems like a normal young woman. Yep. So I don't really know what we're doing here.
Well, it's also this also plays into the hair salon she works at, which also has a very specific aesthetic that kind of like the world that she lives in, or at least the hair salon and the club that they go to, like they certainly seem like they're kind of cool, edgy girls, I guess, is sort of what they're going for a little bit. But they don't go particularly far with it. This is also where we see Portia de Rossi's dreadlocks for the first time in the hair salon. I just want to take a second here because there's a moment, because we just did Black and White a few weeks ago, and Brooke Shields has dreadlocks in that film. And then next year in 2000, we have Angelina Jolie's blonde dreadlocks in Gone in 60 Seconds. Was there sort of this moment where, I guess there was a moment where dreadlocks were okay for white people to have? Was that okay?
I think that this was certainly predating a national conversation on cultural appropriation, if that's what you're asking.
Okay. I think that
I don't think that anyone would have thought I don't think that any like mainstream critic of which almost all of them were white would have thought to be like, why are all these white women wearing dreads?
In Black and White,
the irony of putting
them in with that is very clearly a commentary on that thing.
Yes.
This happened up until 2 years ago. Charlize Theron is wearing dreads in fucking Fast and Furious. So
that's right,
like this only just had its reckoning like last week.
Okay. So then Frankie's hospitalized again. And the priest sends the security tapes of her attack in the train to the Vatican. And Andrew is sent to investigate. Can we just talk for a second about how... So, oh my God, why am I drawing a blank on Gabriel Byrne's... Jonathan Pryce says to Gabriel Byrne, you need to go investigate this. And Gabriel Byrne is like kind of pissed about it. He's like, this is bullshit. Why do I have to go and check this out? Like... This guy's been going to fucking statues in Brazil, but he's like all of a sudden he's pissed to go see a real person that might have stigmata.
Yeah, that character's also really poorly drawn. I think it's like they can't decide if he's like a priest who's lost his way, you know, if he's like an exorcist, like lost his faith guy, or if he's like really devoted and thinks everyone is like, you know, putting on hoaxes and he's angry about that. I don't actually know if they... decided one way or the other what his deal is. But part of that is like, it makes very little sense. He seems very unenthused about this assignment.
There's not a lot of why there too, right? Like you were saying with the whole thing. So this guy starts out as a man of science. He's a chemical engineer or something.
He's sort of a scientist.
He explains to Patricia Arquette that the reason he moved over from science to faith was because there are just things you can't explain. And he thinks it's God that fits into that.
Terrible explanation.
It's a terrible explanation especially when you consider it is also his mission statement for his life and this movie. So instead of being someone who goes and tries to figure out the truth And this isn't a comment on science versus faith, but like that's what a scientist is. That's what a detective is. That's you are going to find out the truth. He's someone who said, I can't figure out the truth, but yet I will do the same job I was always doing. Right? I will go to places where there are unexplainable things happening, and I will try and I will try to figure out what's happening. And I guess part of his job, because he's supposedly in Brazil. This is so embarrassing for the movie, but to look at a window that kind of looks like the Virgin Mary, and he's like, it's just oxidation, not the Virgin Mary. So that's a big part of his job, is to, like, you know, look at like pancakes that look like the Virgin Mary and be like, yeah, it's, you know, it's just the way the butter went. But the other part of his job, I guess, like the jackpot of his job, you know, like the finding, you know, the sequencing of the DNA version for him is like, I can't explain it. It's God. Then what do you do?
Does he not say that like every one of those statues was fake? I mean, I think that, that like until he finds this one, he thinks is real. I mean, he seems to say that like more often than not, these are fake. So it seems like a very unfulfilling job in general.
Well, it's
I would agree.
It sucks. It's a sucky
So he basically job. Has, but this
he's,
is where they
he's
they
like
meet.
Vinny from My Cousin Vinny, who's pointing out the magician, all the things he's doing wrong. That's what his day job is. Like, it's not the Virgin Mary, but
at this
he should
point,
have had a different job. His job should have been man of science. He should have been science guy, and then had to accept that this is not explainable through science in the moment.
I agree with you 100%, and it makes me think about the movie Contact, which I really love.
Great movie.
Jodie Foster, Matthew McConaughey. So you had – she is science, he's religion. But instead what you have here is like an atheist or a non-believer and a believer, but neither of them really believe, which is kind of fucking weird. Like even he's sort of like, yeah, I mean it's all pretty much bullshit, but maybe –
But also, like, they have to believe because it is happening. Like, there's no earthly explanation for what's happening for in front of them.
So he explains to her about the five phases of the stigmata, and she's like, but I'm not religious. And he's like, I'm not really, but, you know, this is happening. And then we have the scene at the club where she's going to go meets up with her friends. They go to a club. And then I actually think that perhaps the most ridiculous of the stigmatas is the crown of thorns. That's the one where she's in the middle of the club and she just starts screaming her face off and blood starts pouring out of her head. And we see all of these like staccato shots of the crown of thorns being jammed into her skull, essentially. And then she just runs out into the street screaming like a lunatic while blood pours down her face. It's the one that – the reason I think it's the most ridiculous of the three thus far. Like the bathtub feels very cinematic, and even the subway car does too. This just feels like if you saw that in the street, you'd be like, oh, well, that person's just crazy. Like there's just
– I'll be like, how's that blood coming down out of nowhere? Like, why are you sweating blood right now?
Yeah. But this leads into – Andrew then follows her essentially into like an alley, aka a blatant soundstage, where you can always tell it's a soundstage when an alley has just a fucking wall that closes it off. So it's a soundstage and there's a car and he follows her in there. And this is the first time that she speaks in Aramaic as like a male voice or sort of like a weird sort of, I don't know.
All right. So something I want to hit on before we get to this part.
Okay.
It was the scene you just talked about in the club that makes me think that this movie might have had a better chance as a lower budget movie, because there could have been some charm to these stigmata things if they were a little more analog. Right. Yeah. Like, Nightmare on Elm Street, like the first time you see Freddy and his arms get all big and it looks so ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's charming. Like it's at that moment, like for all first year in Dream Logic. So like anything kind of plays, but also like, I don't know, like I'm kind of like on board then. I'm like, okay, they're really going for it. This is really scary and really weird. And I think that like she could have got there could have been something a lot crazier there.
You wanted a you wanted a charming crown of thorns.
Yeah, pretty much. No, what I want is charming effects, if that makes sense. I want like gushing blood. I want like people to just be thrown back at horror and blood like splurting on people and just like a little more Peter Jackson or Sam Raimi where you're just kind of like, what is happening?
You're thinking about like the pencil in the foot in Evil Dead. You want like kind of it, like it's like it's gory and gross, but also like very fake looking. Versus kind of, like you know
kind
whatever
of takes you to a place where it's funny, and that's the charm of it I'm getting at. Yeah,
I think along the same lines though, like where this gets really ridiculous. I mean, it's ridiculous the whole way through. But when she runs out of the club and then like causes like 18 car accidents to happen.
She does it like three times.
She keeps doing it. And I think that actually comes from a place of having this bigger budget, of trying to kind of make it bigger, raise the stakes, even though like Stigmata itself should be high enough stakes. But I feel like it's, you know, they're kind of creating this sort of this these car crashes as if there's like more of a disaster happening and the rain and the, you know, whatever. And it's like an action sequence, which is not the point, really. The point is that she's bleeding from her her fake or not fake invisible crown of thorns not the cars crashing.
Can I also just say, and you I want to piggyback on what you just said, because there's a part of me that's like I think I've figured out what my problem with the one of my big problems with the film is, which is there's a dissonance between you're seeing what happened to Jesus and then the effects of said things are happening to her. Like there's a dissonance between those two things, right? So it's like she's not actually having a fucking nail put through her wrist or a crown of thorn put into her. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like there isn't the actual logistics of it or what make my head hurt, where I'm just like, she's having these wounds from things that aren't physically in our world. So it's like invisible crown of thorns or invisible fucking things that are cutting into her body. It just doesn't feel tactile.
That
it
one feels... you just have to accept. I know that.
I'm talking about it on a conceptual level. It has nothing to do with whether or not I can get on board with
that's,
it.
That's my point about these things happening in the real world that are inexplicable, right? So yes, of course you're right. But that's the point. That's the blank that needs to be filled in. How are these wounds happening if nothing in our world is causing them? So,
no, like you're saying more. You don't feel that you're not getting the sense that it's actually just experiencing it.
No, it's more about the fact that it literally is a visual language barrier that I think is the problem for me, which is I'm seeing something happen in I'm assuming Jesus's time or whatever was that are so close up, that are so fucking staccato, and I'm supposed to put those two things together, and it actually visually doesn't make any fucking sense. So at this point, basically, Frankie's in the alleyway. She smashes a bottle and she carves some symbols into the hood of the car. And she yells at him in Aramaic again. And then weirdly, Nia Long shows up. Nia Long doesn't even really have a character in this movie. She's just sort of there periodically, which is sort of a bummer because
she's a good friend.
What does she do in the movie?
She seems to really care.
Her characterization is no worse than any of the other characters in the film.
That's fair. That's fair.
When Patricia Arquette, I think we missed this or is it forthcoming, when Patricia Arquette thinks she sees a baby being dropped.
Oh, that happened already. But
that's the first time Patricia Arquette runs through traffic for no reason.
Yes.
Nia Long runs out after a very concerned.
She does. You know who doesn't care? Portia de Rossi.
No. I mean, why would she?
So. And then basically
it's very odd brand for her.
So then Andrew takes Frankie to Father Durning's church, and the Vatican translates what she was yelling was Aramaic. And then we have that fucking writing on the wall scene that we were talking about earlier. Then we get to a pretty great moment, which is Andrew emails photos from Frankie's apartment to Brother Delmonico, who he just keeps calling Johnny, which I love. Like doesn't call him
is that Enrico Colantino?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I could get that name.
And the priest, these priests are real tech savvy. Like they're on email. They're
emailing. Oh, you're talking about the Dick Latessa one.
Correct.
Yes.
And he's just like, don't tell anyone you saw this. And he starts like deleting everything off the computer.
Right. We got like a cyber thriller moment. there's a floppy disk.
And Veronica Mars's dad is up in the. Oh,
that's who's Enrico Colantoni. Yeah. But the other guy is the guy who looked. What movie is that where the guy? Oh, he looks like what was that horrible movie? Boondock Saints. He looks like Billy.
Yes. The dad. Yeah.
Yes, the dad. What's that guy's name? Billy, the Irish actor.
Irish guy. Billy. Fuck, I can't remember his last name. Yeah. Either way, get this sort of like. Cyber sort of techie thriller as much as 99 can afford, essentially, where he sends him some photos and he's like, dude, this is from a document of a church found by like that. There's some new gospel and you have to just pretend you didn't see this at all, which was kind of fun, I guess. And then it sort of, I don't know, it really devolves into a bunch of kind of bullshit that I just can't really.
You have some real DVD box quotes here, which is almost always like that was kind of fun, I guess. That's like the best you could do for the DVD box, I think.
Which is a fair assessment of most of what happens.
I at this point, Phil, once Billy, what's his name, Cochran or whatever, comes into the movie, I'm out. Like my
Graham,
my,
Billy Graham, maybe.
No. Billy Graham, the superstar Billy Graham, the wrestler. No, it's I don't know either one of these actors' names are, unfortunately, but I do know that I did not understand what he was doing in the movie. and I did stop like kind of caring at this point, having already decided that I was going to like the movie. So it was
Kenny. For the love, like, I'm honestly, like, I can read the rest of this plot synopsis, and we can do that, but it doesn't make any fucking sense. It devolves into a series of, to your point, Kenny, a bunch of priests that I don't know who they are, other than Veronica's dad and Jonathan Pryce.
Only because you know he's Veronica's dad, not because you know what he does in the movie.
Exactly. I don't understand really the hierarchy of anything. Long story short, it basically comes down to the fact that there was this other scroll or what have you that Jesus wrote down that essentially states that like churches are bullshit and you should just believe whatever you believe in yourself. Believe whatever you want to believe. Everything's going to be fine. And that was kind of how Jesus saw
things. Jesus really was a prophet.
Right. And obviously the church can't have that. So they try to do an exorcism on Frankie. Why?
Well,
they change anything.
They're trying to kill her, I think, but they're doing it under the pretense of an exorcism. They are strangling her.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
Well, it's very. I was taking notes. Like, is this an exorcism? Is this supposed to be an exorcism or a straight up murder? I think it's yes, it's both. But they're definitely trying to kill her because they don't want this getting out there. I don't know what that would, you know. Would solve. I think, you know, as you've said, it's a bunch of bullshit. It's a conspiracy thriller. It's, you know, about the Catholic Church, but then also she's possessed and also trying to seduce this priest for some reason. And then like also that she has stigmata, but how that ties into the rest of it, is unclear.
I mean, the irony of this film is that it's called Stigmata. It's about stigmata, it seems. And yet it's never explained why she's actually suffering from this condition. She gets possessed at one point. They think it's Alameda's spirit at one point that's inside her body.
I mean, I think that's where he ends up at the end when he finally, you know, confronts her and the fire and the doves. I believe he's like talking to Alameda. So I think that's ultimately what.
But is Alameda bad?
I think no, he's just good. Angry.
But no. Okay.
He's good. All right.
Hold on. Because I think that he's possessed her body and he's taken the form of essentially he sounds like a demon. So like, I know part of it's like message and messenger and medium and all of that, but like
someone sounds like a demon doesn't mean they are a demon. Okay. First, secondly, this is all, there's a lot of this is regurgitating what Lewis has said. My understanding is now Alameda had a goal for humanity.
Okay.
And Patricia Arquette may or may not have to be collateral damage in getting that message out to humanity. The Catholic Church has to suppress this message or else they will no longer exist. And that assumes that Patricia Arquette somehow is able to get this message out to humanity, overcoming 2,000 years of Catholic, you know, of the Catholic Church. But that, I think, is what's going on. Now, what I'm really kind of grappling with right now is how I could possibly give a passing grade to what is objectively a bad movie.
Yeah, no, you're not going to. So here's what I'm gonna.
You're right.
Let's just to wrap this up. Basically,
it's also a cynical movie, I would say.
Gabrielle Byrne walks through fire. She's on her bedroom's on digital fire because none of it looks real. It's just a whole bunch of fake fire that he walks through and essentially saves her from this possession, or his spirit departs in peace. Alameda's spirit departs in peace or some shit. And then later we see Andrew returns back to that church from the beginning and he opens up the original documents of this lost gospel. And then we get some fucking text that says that they discovered the Gospel of Thomas, stating that the Catholic Church also refuses to recognize this document as gospel and considers it heresy. So that's the fucking movie. I don't want to talk about the plot of this film anymore.
You really didn't like this movie. Like I can tell you're upset.
I mean, I'm upset because, I mean, upset's the wrong word. I'm annoyed, I guess, because
unsettled. I think the movie did its job.
No, I think there's a. I think I'm a little annoyed because I was hoping that you guys would be able to sort of like logic out this movie for me, because I was annoyed as I was watching it because it wasn't making any sense to me. And then I'm reading this and I'm walking through it with you guys, and it's basically clear it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make sense. I think that like it's fun to talk about some of the bits of the movie, but once you start trying to untangle the plot, it's like an extra. It's just like you're going nowhere fast.
Well, right. I think what you're hitting on, Phil, is something that I'm not feeling quite as strongly as you, because, you know, I never really cared. But the more we get into it, the more I realize, you know, I threw the word out a few minutes ago, but it's a cynical movie. Mm-hmm. The cynicism comes from this idea that people will be attracted to the gore, attracted to the sex, attracted to the, you know, the heresy, frankly, and not put much thought into how to tie that together with a with a cohesive narrative. What they do seem to have is like what I just kind of distilled, again, based mostly on what Lewis said, is they do have a idea that they're working with. Like they see, these writers seem to be kind of taken with the idea that, they seem to be really, really enraptured with this idea that there is this scroll that came from Jesus that the Catholic Church is suppressing. Okay, I get it. That's a movie, but they couldn't tell that story. So they didn't want to tell that story. They didn't think that story was sexy enough, or didn't lend itself to, you know, Patricia Arquette naked in a tub getting, you know, stigmata through her wrists. So they wrapped it. They wrapped it in this packaging that looks a little like Seven. You know, which, like, frankly, is just the worst fucking movie to try to emulate. Because just don't. Because, like, it's going to be bad and upsetting. So I think that is why this movie went from kind of fun to me to kind of not fun to me. Because
it has fun moments.
I think it does have fun moments. I think they were trying to pull an over on us, ultimately. And that's what kind of upsets me.
I think that it's just – it's
but we didn't let them.
Well, we did. We gave him $90 million.
we personally gave him $90 million.
I just met the three of us, man. Us three movie detectives figured him out.
Well, I think that the way that you're describing it to me is more like there was more logic behind it. Like that, like we have to kind of like. I think that there was a lot of cynicism in terms of like a studio trying to market this movie, and you know maybe like working from perspective of like people want to see Patricia Arquette, you know, bloody and naked, and whatever. But I actually think that like what happened here with the story going in all these different directions is much more just like throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks, and less about trying to, like, I think that there was actually an attempt to make something like fun and engaging, and they had so many ideas and in total incompetence at pulling them off, because it's like there's no reason to throw in these things like the sort of cyber thriller, like, you know, floppy disk scene, and, you know, the woman in the street with the baby, and all, like, all this weird shit that happens that's like totally inexplicable on top of a plot that makes no sense. I think that someone was like excited about this. I think that it actually was like someone trying to do some cool shit that they saw in other movies and thought might work here. But I do agree with you that, like, at a very basic level, it's like no one cared because they thought that it would be enough, that it would work anyway. And they were right. Like, the movie did well, and audiences liked it more than we did.
I mean, there is something kind of shocking about, you know, I obviously did a little bit of research in terms of how well it did. And you're just like, you don't get to $90 million without a couple people seeing this more than once.
Are there so people
Are there
humans our age, older than us, maybe younger than us, who love this movie? I feel like there is. I feel like this is not a it's come up, Phil. It's come up a lot in terms of when we've given people lists, people have said, I would do Stigmata. You know, so it's not like one of the forgotten movies. Yep. Like, no one says I want to do For Love of the Game. But
damn it.
no one yet.
Right. My mistake.
And I don't think it's, you know, people want to do it because they think it's trashy and we'll shit all over it. I think there are a lot of people who'd like this movie, or at least have a memory of liking it.
I haven't, I mean, from personal experience, have not talked to anyone who's like, I love Stigmata. I'm not saying those people don't exist, but like, I don't see it on bad movie lists. I don't see it on good movie lists. Like, I don't think it, like, it's not totally forgotten. You're right. But I think that, like, I don't know. I don't think it's a ton of like fondness and nostalgia for this movie. And for me, like, I saw that on the list and I was like, oh, I remember that trailer. And like, it seemed really like, you know, racy and exciting and like naughty at the time. And now I want to watch it as an adult and find out how much it sucks. But like, I don't know. I do think it's kind of, you know, I feel like same thing about End of Days. Like, that's a movie that I remember the trailer for, but I rarely hear it talked about as like a, you know, a cultural moment. So I don't know.
Stigmata has a much bigger, I think Stigmata has a much bigger footprint than
really.
I agree.
And End of Days is a significantly better movie.
Do you know why I remember End of Days though? Is because of the trailer where you see
the guy with the weird.
No. The part where you see the year 1999. And it flips upside down and it says 666. And I remember being like, oh, fuck. We're in for... Because I was 13 and I was like, this is scary shit.
That's like the Batman Forever moment when they, you know, draw the Riddler sign over the Batman sign. It's like...
The question mark.
Yeah, the question mark. That's right.
How did we miss this? It was there all along in plain sight.
You're a hero now.
Lewis, we rate the movies that we do on this podcast.
Oh, fabulous.
So from 0 to 99, 0 being the obviously the lowest, 99 being the highest, 50 is the threshold of recommending or not recommending. Did you see this film in 99? No, you saw this was the first time you saw it the other day. So basically what we try to do is rate it before and after the podcast. So basically that the podcast might change your opinion one way or the other. Now, my guess is you are pretty locked in before and after, but yes. Do you have a rating for this film from 0 to 99?
So you give it a number rating on that scale. Has anyone ever tried to go past 99?
Yes. Everyone says, why isn't there 100?
No, I understand the concept of the podcast. I wanted to know if people were cheating. I will give this movie a Christly 33.
Yeah. I like that.
So I saw this film
because he died at 33, to be clear. That was reference to Jesus. Sorry. All right, just want to make sure that all the heathens listening know that I was deliberately giving it a 33. Okay.
How annoying is it? Would he accomplish by 33? Oh,
it's pretty crazy. Yeah, yeah. So I saw this film in 99 on a date, actually. The date was fine, but the movie was not memorable. I don't remember much about it. But I probably would have given it a 40 in 99 is probably where I would have lied. I wouldn't have recommended it, but I didn't like it. Before this podcast, I was down to a 35. And now after this podcast, I'm down to like a 22.
Damn. You dislike this movie. Like deeply.
I did dislike this movie. I think this movie's just, it's kind of beneath everybody.
I do not dislike this movie as deeply as you gentlemen do.
Okay.
But I do dislike this movie. However, after watching it, I gave it a 53. I mean, my notes on it are just hilarious. I mean, my notes are mostly just mostly like every third note is like, "Will you two just fuck? Will you two just fuck?" And then
they wouldn't do it.
I mean, I have one note of that is just fuck, 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 and like a good one.
Jesus
I mean,
Christ.
fornicate. It just felt like it was made for dummies. And
because it was.
I agree. It's for dummies, but like. You wonder if a movie is for dummies, if the filmmakers are dummies or if they're really cynical assholes. And I kind of feel like this might be a little bit of both. I do think, you know, there is a so bad it's good element to it. I do think there's a midnight movie element to it. I do think, you know, with the right kind of substances in your body and the right people sitting next to you, you could have a lot of fun with a movie like this. I can't keep it at 53. I mean, I have a professional reputation to uphold, but I'm only gonna go down to a 42. I do not think this is an abomination by any stretch. I've seen so many worse movies than this. over the course of this podcast, I think this is a more or less adequate film.
Here's what I'm gonna say. I don't have any stake in this. Ultimately, what everything is said and done in terms of how you rate Stigmata, but I think. This was one of those things where you had a better time than I did watching this film, right? Like you just enjoyed the sort of preposterousness of it. I think that you were able to kind of let go of any kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but
expectations. And that's what it was for me. I got in on the silly reel during the credit sequence. I was like, all right, so there's some strong silly in this movie. So I think that's the key, right?
Like the silliness locked in for you. It came in and went for me, which is part of why the last 20 minutes to a half an hour of this film are a fucking slog.
It's intense.
Like they are brutal. Where it leaves me.
And not to belabor the point, the difference between this and End of Days is End of Days is very aware that it's doing a silly movie.
And it got $100 million budget to do it.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't look great, but End of Days is like, all right, so we're all on the same page. It's a very silly concept. Let's have some fun. Sigmund is like, we're all on the same page. It's some serious shit, right guys?
It's such a weird movie to talk about and dissect because it's like a pile of shit that was like, you know, we're all agreeing that it's not good. That like it's some combination of like studio cynicism and people who are bad at their jobs. We all agree on this, and yet like the movie is fundamentally about how the Catholic Church is, you know, a failed institution that's like based on a lie, and actually like they would kill to keep the secret from coming out, the true words of Jesus. It's like a wild concept, highly sacrilegious. Like should have been picketed. I don't know if it was. Whatever. But like buried under a literal pile of shit. So I don't, it's weird. It's like a hard movie to pick apart. That's why, like, you know, I want to enjoy it on a so bad it's good level, but I feel like there's like almost too much going on to do that. I can't, it made me think, and that's annoying for a movie this bad.
That should have been on the poster. It made me think, and that's annoying for a movie of this caliber.
They can just quote the first part. It made me think if they want to, you know, it's fine.
Dot, dot, dot.
It made me think.
Or just annoying, you know, just like to pull, take a word out.
Well, next week we're doing an episode on the 1999 Golden Globe Awards.
All right.
I don't know, Lewis, if you have any thoughts on the Golden Globe Awards. They were. I mean, it's a great episode. But
we've
already recorded it,
and we're pretty proud of it. It's a good one.
Yeah, the Golden Globes, I think, have consistently, over their history, awarded more bad movies awards than the Razzies. That's my
interesting.
Take. That's my take on the Golden Globes.
That's a bold take. I think that.
I don't think it's wrong.
It's hyperbolic. It's not. I mean, it's an exaggeration.
I think Phil came into the episode not necessarily thinking that the Golden Globes were bad, not really value judgment, just that the Golden Globes are only a piece of entertainment, right? The Golden Globes are 3 hours of entertainment that happens on NBC every whatever February or January, whatever it is, which they certainly are. But I think that there's an alternate history of Hollywood in terms of like the canonization of film that could be told through the Golden Globes that is interesting in its own right. Because like, as you guys know, the Oscars fuck up all the time too. So I'm not super, I've never been like super crazed about the right movie winning. The right movie winning for me is generally the movie that wins because it's really just about what people thought at the time. And I'm more interested in the thought process that goes into awarding a, you know, Moonlight or Green Book than making sure that, you know, you get the movies you want up there.
Right.
And I do think that there's something interesting in terms of like what the Golden Globes has honored who they invite to their ceremonies, why they invite them to their ceremonies, and also like what they're trying to prove. Which is like an interesting thing as well.
Well, I want to say that I think it's a great episode that we did, but I think one of the things that for me was the most interesting is I think the Golden Globes are kind of, you know, the trashy Oscars, you know, weird stepchild thing. Like, I think that that's kind of the way that they're thought of. And my takeaway from the episode was that on a television level, the Golden Globes are actually pretty fucking groundbreaking.
They're better than the stuff. There's no question about that.
They are the range. I mean, specifically in this episode or in this award show, Lewis, you know, it was the first time that The Sopranos and Sex and the City were both awarded anything. They both won Best Comedy and Best Drama. It would take many years before the Emmys would get on board that. I think that the Golden Globes are surprisingly groundbreaking in terms of awarding, you know, television shows in a moment and recognizing and pointing at them and saying you should give this show a shot before the Emmys get on board.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense in terms of TV, at least, that it's that they're a little bit like, you know, ahead of the curve. I think when you remember that it's like what 70 people voting, totally. And I think that also the fact that people get drunk there makes it a more dynamic experience to watch.
Absolutely.
So
we have Eric Anderson coming on for that episode from Awards Watch. And he's fantastic. But yeah, sorry, Kenny, what were you saying?
No, I don't even remember. Just about the awards. Basically, the Golden Globes have been screaming, or the Hollywood Foreign Press Association have been screaming for the last 80 years, we exist, pay attention. And over the last 20 years, what they stopped doing, definitely in TV, but in films too, to some extent, is saying, we're going to try to predict what's going to happen at the Oscars. And what they started to do is we're going to throw some of our weird shit against the wall and see if that works. And that distinguishes ourselves. So that leads to like kind of what you were saying in the beginning, Lewis, which like they have awarded some shitty movies, and they've also awarded like Three Billboards one, which is a bad, shitty movie, but like they've also awarded
Bohemian Rhapsody.
They've also awarded some good movies that don't get nominated, or that don't get awarded at the Oscars. Some good performances that, you know, things that we all feel like should have, like,
Tom Cruise for Magnolia.
Tom Cruise for Magnolia is exactly what I was thinking. Or Sylvester Stallone for Creed. Things like things along that line, and it's just a fun little alternate look at the last.
It was a really fun episode to do, and it really kind of it changed my perspective on the Golden Globes. I think that they often are kind of the butt of a lot of jokes, understandably, because the budgets are low, people drink and like fucking eat during speeches. Like it's ridiculous. But I had a really great time talking with Kenny and Eric about it. So that'll be up next week. But Lewis, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. And again, for getting me to finally watch Stigmata.
If nothing else, you've watched it now. but we hope that you'll come back in the future, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, guys.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.